Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. This is the northern panel of the Nevada Supreme Court. Justice Sato on my right, Justice Gibbons on my left. Our first and only case today is case number 52044, Extreme Faith Academy versus Landry. And Mr. Olson, are you ready on behalf of the appellant cross respondent?
Yes, Your Honor.
Justice Cherry, Justice Sata, Justice Gibbons, I'm John Olson. I represent the cross-appellants and plaintiffs below together with my partner, Ann Hall. We tried the matter below and we're pleased to be here on this appeal. Members of the court, this is an intentional tort. An intentional tort that was accomplished through the means of misdirection, pretext, and mendacity. The jury found that it was also accomplished with malice. The question in this case, and the primary question, especially considering the precedent that exists in this state, is whether or not the caps, statutory caps, on damages ought to be applied as to one tort per plaintiff, or they ought to be applied as the case was pled in regards to the 33 children that were taken by the defendants in this case. Now, we, of course, assert that the caps ought to be applied as to each of the three of the 33 children that were removed from Abundant Life Academy by the defendants. The defendant's position is that this was basically one act of removal, and that the fact that 33 children were removed merely represents evidence of the actions and not individual causes of action within the meaning of the one claim, one plaintiff rule.
There's three plaintiffs in this case.
There are three plaintiffs. Okay. They're the school itself, the Abundant Life Academy, Hidden Canyon Ranch, who was the lessor of the school outside of Ely, and one of the teachers at the school are the three plaintiffs that at the trial of this matter. I've been thinking for the past week since we argued the companion case to this in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals last Friday. The best way to illustrate our position through some kind of analogy, and the best thing I come up with is to candidly state to the court that this is an unusual circumstance that doesn't really fit into any of the categories of existing precedent. Let me tell you why I believe that's the case. If everything were the same in this case, if the defendants had pre-planned to shut this school down and take all 33 children before an investigation, if they had made that decision to do so, as has been found in a couple of different judicial proceedings, if they'd proceeded to White Pine County en masse, ready to carry out what they decided to do, and instead of going out there, there were a couple of trips out to the ranch from Ely, instead of going out there on the last trip with buses and taking the children all at that time, they'd have said, well, okay, we'll stay here at the jailhouse hotel in Ely, and we're going to pick up one child a day for the next 33 days. Now, every time they picked up a child wrongfully, it would have been damages to the plaintiffs in this case. And I don't think anybody would seriously be arguing under those circumstances that there was only one tort to which one cap would apply. Instead, what they did, well, let me back up. The first was an inspection of the premises in which members of CPS decided that they couldn't find sufficient infractions to take the children. They reported that back. Ms. Landry, one of the individual defendants, said, well, I'm coming out there and I'll conduct the investigation myself. She went out, they made an investigation. They came out the next morning, they took the children, they put them on a bus. Those children didn't all get on a bus at the same time. They interviewed each of those children. The children somehow got on the bus individually, and they left. So one day at a time, one child one day, one child 1 hour, one child every 15 seconds. What difference does it make?
Mr. Olson, if I can digress for 1 second, I don't want to take up your time. Perhaps Justice Chair will give you some more time. I had a case as a trial judge in Clark County District Court where a 49-year-old worker for DFS it was a statutory rape of a 14-year-old girl, was in custody in Lincoln County, and there were 7 incidents, and the girl got pregnant and had a baby. And the state argued in that case in front of me that it's really one incident, it's $50,000, that's it. And I said, no, it's 7, and I think it was appealed, and the jury awarded 7, and it was appealed. And I don't think it was ever decided. It was must have been settled, but I made that decision. So I thought a lot about this spacing. Now, those happened on separate days. It was over a course of a period of time. It wasn't one. So I don't know what I would have done if it happened. If it was 7 incidents in one day, let's say, because I understand your point, but it's something I've been wrestling with as well, and what the law is now. I'll be interested in what the state says about that also.
The case that you decided is the classic, and the classic decision. And the thing that makes that a little bit easier to decide in this case is that the incidences of sexual assault happen on different days. But suppose that the tortfeasor in your case had come in the morning and assaulted this child, and then at noon,
right,
and then at 5 p.m., and then at 8 p.m. I don't think that the result would have been any different because of the distinction. Mm-hmm. And in this case, and what's really, really makes the difference in this case, is that while there wasn't a sexual assault, CPS was acting and purported to act under statutory authority, which says, okay, if the child is in imminent danger of serious harm, then you can remove the child. The child. They went to the premises and they conducted an investigation. They interviewed all the children. Now, surely, after that process, they really couldn't say, well, all of them were abused or neglected and we need to remove them. They made individual decisions. And the fact that it was bunched into one day and one investigative process doesn't make it any less an individual decision for each child. And the distinction is, especially when you take the pretext in this case, I think what we established in the lower court, what inflamed the jury sufficiently, and what motivated Judge Dobrescu to write the opinion he wrote after the 432B hearing, 72-hour hearing, was that the decision was to shut the school down. Now, you don't shut the school down by taking one child. You probably don't shut the school down by taking 2 children. You probably don't shut the school down by taking 3 children. But if you're really concerned about a child's welfare, that's the way you decide it and that's the way you look at it. So what happened in this case was essentially, in retrospect, what the DCSF is able to argue is that, well, you know, we're able to limit our damages. We've abused our power and our authority. We've acted wrongfully. We've acted in such a way that a jury says we've acted oppressively and with malice. And so now we're going to decide how much we owe you. And interestingly, if you look in the briefs, the state's brief on this case, the state makes a point in the brief of saying, at no point in time was there ever an order ordering the children back to Abundant Life Academy. Well, Abundant Life Academy ceased to exist. They were the children were taken. They lost their revenues. They had to return tuition funds to parents. Their reputation was absolutely ruined and destroyed in this action.
Mr. Olson, I ask you on another issue, the immunity issue, Discretionary Act immunity. At the time this case was decided, the case law was in one state. We since had the case Martinez versus Maruzak, and. Also in reviewing the record here, I noticed I think neither side filed the trial transcript. If I missed it, please let me know. So that kind of handicaps us maybe in, you know, looking through exactly what all the nuances of what happened in district court. Number one, should that case apply to this situation? Should we review it in light of Martinez versus Muruzak? And how should is that issue of discretionary act immunity, would you say it's a mixed issue of law and fact, or is it a straight issue of law? How would you approach that?
I'd hope to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm getting close to my 5 minutes, but I want to answer your question because I think it's an important question. I think that the case exists as an example of good law, and but I think it's distinguishable. As I recall the case, it requires there are two elements that have to be established for discretionary immunity. The first is that there is an element of judgment or discretion. The second, that there's a social, economic, or political policy involved in the decision itself. In this case, there was an element of choice, or judgment, or discretion involved. But as to the second, the fact that the DCSF acted essentially for an ulterior motive and in bad faith vitiates the proposition that there's a social, economic, or political policy.
So that is that an issue of fact for the trier of fact?
There is both. And I was just thinking before we started, discretionary immunity issue was brought up in the motion for summary judgment.
Right.
The DCSF lost on that issue. Then the entire record was developed, all the facts, instead of just the affidavits, most of which, by the way, were impeached at trial. Record was developed, and now the state says, wait a minute. What we want you to do is reverse the district court on its summary judgment decision based upon that record, when the district court got to see the entire facts at the end, and we didn't move for a JNOV or for any type of relief after all the facts were developed. So I think there's a waiver element there as well. And I know I'm running over my time, and whatever your honor.
Well, if I can ask one more question.
Well, I'll give you some extra time, and I'll give the state.
I hate to take up attorney's time, and when I was an attorney,
I'm
hated
here at your pleasure.
Judges to take my time up. But anyway, on that, my other question would be is, didn't the state still preserve the issue for appeal? Because they did raise it in district court on the discretionary act of immunity, and granted the record may have changed and all that, but they have a right to argue that issue.
That's an interesting question, because Nevada case law is almost the same as federal case law on qualified immunity and discretionary immunity. And federal case law takes it just a step further. And some of the cases say, well, discretionary immunity or qualified immunity is a bar to suit. It's not a defense. And as such, if a case goes to trial, even erroneously, you've waived it. So if it's a bar to suit and you make the motion in district court, and you lose in district court, you must bring the issue forward prior to trial.
We have said, though, that if you file a motion in limine and the motion in limine is ruled on one way or the other, that preserves it for appeal. You don't have to argue it or object at the time of the trial to avoid unnecessary objections.
A little bit different, because I agree that in most instances, if you preserve the objection for the record in the trial court, you don't have to keep doing it ad nauseum. But it's a little bit different when you're looking at an issue that says, okay, this is a proposition that says you can't even be sued. You shouldn't even be here. And the idea that you're being sued here is offensive to the doctrine of discretionary immunity. So once you've made that motion, and in federal court the cases are explicit, and our cases just get up to that point and stop. I think that we do recognize that it is a bar to suit, but we don't say you're done if you don't reiterate it. In any event, regardless, the state didn't preserve the issue on appeal because they did not preserve on appeal the entire trial record, which, as you say, would have given rise to the nuances. We saw that in the face of this appeal when we cross-appealed and said to ourselves, well, we don't need a record for the issues that we're advancing, and we're happy that the state didn't preserve that issue, because now they're not going to be able to argue it.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Nichols, I'm going to give you an additional 3 minutes because I'm going to give Mr. Olson additional 3 minutes. You'll have 4 minutes in rebuttal, and you'll have 18 minutes.
Thank you. Of that 18 minutes, may I also reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Whatever's your pleasure.
Thank you, Ron.
This is Ms. Nichols from the Attorney General's Office.
It's almost redundant for me to say then, may it please the court. I'm Andrea Nichols. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. It's my great pleasure and honor to be here today representing Robin Landry on the Division of Child and Family Services. The first issue that I want to address is the issue of discretionary immunity. And getting back to what Mr. Olson was just talking about and Judge Gibbons' question of whether or not it's a question of law or a question of fact, this court had previously held, I believe in the Duff case, that discretionary immunity was just a question of law. They have since refined that to say that it's a mixed question of law and fact, but under the undisputed facts of this case, there is no factual issue to be resolved with respect to the issue of discretionary immunity.
What about Mr. Olson saying this ulterior motive claim and all like
that? Oh, well, you know, that's very interesting, Your Honor. Under NRS 41, I believe it's 032, which is the discretionary immunity statute, it clearly states that discretionary immunity applies whether or not the discretion involved is abused. So abuse of discretion doesn't matter. Mr. Olson has argued that there's some sort of bad faith, and actually in his brief he cited to the case of Faline versus GNL, and this very court in that case did a great job of distinguishing abuse of discretion from bad faith. And bad faith involves acting totally outside of the scope of your statutory authority. In this case, Robin Landry and several other social workers, I want to emphasize that she didn't act alone in a vacuum, were within their discretionary authority, and that's conferred upon them in NRS 432B, I believe it's .390, where they have authority to remove children when they believe them to be in imminent risk of abuse, or they believe that they've been abused and neglected or are in danger of abuse or neglect. And I want to point this court to the United States versus Gobert, which is a United States Supreme Court case that applies discretionary immunity. And in that case, they said the inquiry and the focus of the inquiry is not on the agent's subjective intent in exercising the discretion conferred by a statute or regulation, but on the nature of the actions taken and on whether they are susceptible to policy analysis. So according to the United States Supreme Court, Ms. Landry's subjective intent really doesn't matter. It's whether her actions were discretionary and was she acting within the scope of her authority and carrying out the policy of the state. And clearly the policy of the state from NRS 432B is the protection of children. And I would also emphasize that a finding of discretionary immunity for social workers is consistent with this court's prior case of Foster versus Washoe County, when this court itself said social workers must be absolutely immune from suits alleging the improper investigation of child abuse, removal of a minor from the parental home based upon suspicion of abuse, and the instigation of dependency proceedings. That's this Nevada Supreme Court. That's the precedent here. And it's consistent with other jurisdictions. And in fact, the Supreme Court of Vermont in Earl versus State of Vermont relied on Foster versus Washoe County in finding that social workers investigating allegations of abuse and neglect were entitled to discretionary immunity. And in my brief, I've cited other cases from other jurisdictions that apply discretionary immunity in the context of child abuse investigations. There's Earl versus State of Vermont that I just mentioned that cites to Foster, Jacqueline T. versus Alameda County, Hensley versus Standing Rock Child Protective Services, McLean versus Gordon, and these are from all over the United States, New York, North Dakota, Vermont, California. So it would be consistent to find discretionary immunity in this case.
I guess, Ms. Nichols, my concern in looking at this case, and this is, I think, one of the first big cases we've had since Martinez came out, is that not having a trial transcript, if there is a mixed issue of law and fact where the finder of fact has to apply the law on this, how do we dig into that and look at it?
Well,
without
Honor,
a transcript, aren't we kind of handcuffed in that regard?
My contention, Your Honor, is that this is a case that never should have gone to trial because the undisputed facts lean in favor of discretionary immunity. I believe that the district court erred in not granting a motion for judgment on the pleadings. I don't think it should have even gone farther than that. But then the district court erred a second time in not granting the motion for summary judgment. And there's nothing in the trial transcript. The issue of discretionary immunity was not tried at trial. And there's nothing in the trial transcript that would support not finding it. And if there was something in there, I think that the plaintiff's attorney should have pointed that out.
Now,
how can I...
Well, Mr. Olson's saying the issue isn't preserved for appeal. You heard his argument on that. You did file the motions and the summary judgment motion to dismiss. So what's your position on whether it's preserved for appeal?
Oh, well, not only did we file the summary judgment motion, but we filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings as well. This court has always allowed the issue of discretionary immunity to be appealed after trial. And I believe in my briefs I cited to the case of UNR versus Stacy, where the case went to trial, jury returned a verdict in favor of UNR, the university timely filed its appeal, and this very court found the university immune from suit because its actions were discretionary. Now, and Mr. Olson, I think, really confuses discretionary immunity with qualified immunity, and if I could address that very briefly. This court adopted the test for discretionary immunity in the Martinez case, using the United States Supreme Court cases of Gaubert and
Berkowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Berkowitz
v. Gaubert.
Yeah.
Those cases interpret the Federal Tort Claims Act. The Ninth Circuit cases applying discretionary immunity in the context of the Federal Tort Claims Act allow appeal after a trial because they have found that whether discretionary immunity applies really is a question of law. But again, let me emphasize, and the cases I would cite to for that are Kelly versus U.S., Risk v. Kingdom of Norway, and Fang versus United States. And those are Ninth Circuit cases interpreting discretionary immunity under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Mr. Olson kind of confused qualified immunity with discretionary immunity, but the Ninth Circuit has also held under qualified immunity that you can appeal after the issue of qualified immunity after trial. And I cited cases for that in my brief as well. I believe it's Dinieva versus Reyes and Ribeiro versus City and County of San Francisco. So it's consistent with the law interpreting the law of discretionary immunity in both this court and in the federal courts that you can appeal the issue after trial even if you lose that trial. And the reason being that most courts say it's a question of law. This court has said it's a mixed question of law and fact, but to resolve this case, you don't have to resolve an issue of law. Or I'm sorry, you do have to resolve an issue of law. You don't have to resolve an issue of fact because it's undisputed that the Division of Child and Family Services conducted an investigation and removed children. And as I pointed out in my brief, that's right in the facts of the appellant's brief, after conducting an investigation. Now, Mr. Olson made it seem like DCFS went out there and found that the children were safe, everything was fine, and Robin Landry rushed out and said, we're going to remove. That's not the case. The undisputed facts, and you can look in the record that appellant submitted as well as the record that we submitted, they show that DCFS went out there on April 21st. They went out there again April 23rd. After receiving another complaint, they visited the Sunnyside Ranch on April 24th. They went out there again on May 1st. And it was the team that went out there on May 1st that said, those kids aren't safe. We got to get them out of here. And they went back on May. They got buses and went back on May 2nd and removed those children. And I would ask the court to note that there's nothing in the record from anybody who was there on May 1st saying that the children should not be removed. In our respondents' record on appeal, volume 1, we submitted the affidavits of Robin Landry, Rob Lawler, Deborah Norton, Ted Tuso, Erica Olson, and Denise Perry. Those are the folks that went out there May 1st. And every single one of those people, and I can give you pinpoint sites, every single one of those people said, we thought those children were in danger and that they needed to be removed. And interestingly, Mr. Olson says this would be a different case if the children were removed one at a time. But I'd specifically point to the affidavit of Deborah Norton on page 96. And she says that it is accepted social work practice that when you remove a child, you don't leave other children in the same home. Ms. Olson earned her bachelor's in social work in 1976 and first was licensed as a social worker in 1979. I think she's pretty credible in that regard. That brings me very quickly to the argument of the tort cap. This court has said that a claim and a cause of action are the same thing. Most recently, I believe it was the Richardson construction case where, it was Clark County School District versus Richardson Construction, where Richardson argued that Clark County engaged in 5 separate instances of tortious interference. And so he was entitled to 5 separate applications of the tort cap. This very court said, no, you have one claim or one cause of action, and that was for, in that case, interference with a contract. In this case, one claim, one cause of action.
What about my case that I mentioned where the girl was, there was a statutory rape on seven occasions over a period of time. I don't recall over, well, but it certainly wasn't the same day. Are those 7 claims, or are they one?
I believe they're one claim, one cause of action, Your Honor, and that's under this court's precedent in Clark County versus Richardson Construction. It's the same thing. It's 5 separate breaches of contract. It's one claim, one cause of action. And then very quickly, I just want to address the action of abusive process. In this jurisdiction, abusive process requires an ulterior purpose other than resolving a legal dispute and a willful act in the use of the legal process not proper in the regular conduct of the proceeding. It's undisputed that the Division of Child and Family Services and Robin Landry never brought a lawsuit or any kind of legal action against any of the 3 plaintiffs in this lawsuit. And unless the court has other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
We'll reserve 4 minutes and 39 seconds for Ms. Nichols.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 4 minutes.
Thank you. Listening to counsel, you'd think that there wasn't a trial, that a jury hadn't heard the facts in this case, that there wasn't a 72-hour hearing before the trial, and that the jury hadn't returned verdicts after listening to these same witnesses whose affidavits were given before trial. Now, if you look at Judge Papez's decisions after trial, the first decision, not the one reconsidering, he recognizes that those witnesses were impeached, and they were all impeached. They were shown to have been deceptive in their affidavits and in their actions. And if you look at Volume 1, the Record on Appeal, pages 1 through 13 is Judge DeBrescu's order. Now, notwithstanding the fact that last week I heard a federal judge refer to Judge DeBrescu as some judge, just because some judge had decided something, but the federal judges are more important than we are. This is what Judge DeBrescu said. This case, however, appears to be one in which the decision to close ALA was made prior to any investigation. And once the local investigators were unable to find evidence to support a finding of immediate need to remove, the rural manager took it upon herself to take over the investigation. It appears the focus was then to find grounds to remove the children. Now, in terms of the discretionary immunity, it's the second prong that hangs them. Some policy, some legitimate state policy. And I would submit to this court that there is not now and there has never been a legitimate state policy of the state of Nevada to act inappropriately, to act wrongfully, with pretext, with deception. Never has been. And it isn't now. And that's why the discretionary immunity fails. That's why it is a mixed question of law and fact. And that's why the entire record is what developed and established that.
What about Richardson on this tort issue, then, like that Ms. Nichols said, that she feels that the Richardson case says that you can't get multiple tort recoveries here?
I'm not sure the Richardson case says that. I think the Richardson case says that when the city breaches a contract with a contractor, and there are five basic parts of the breach of contract, but basically it's a breach of contract, that you've got one cause of action. And I think that's what Richardson stands for. It doesn't say that because you rape a little girl seven times, you're limited to one cause of action, or whether you rape a school and destroy it by removing 33 children, you're limited to one cause of action. If the bottom line on this is if the state were acting appropriately, as counsel suggests that they were, and as the record belies, because the record, the verdicts that are here belie, then what they'd have done and gone out there and found a child that really was abused and neglected and removed that child. I won't go into that because the record would be needed to support that. But I've been litigating this case for over 4 years, almost 5 years now, in various different forums, federal and state court, and different manners, and it still impresses me that the state can have the boldness to appear before a tribunal and say, well, yeah, we were out there on the pretext, and because we were there under the pretext, we're immune. This is what we do. We go remove children. This is not what you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nichols. Ms. Nichols, you have 4 minutes and 39 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to point out just a few facts that are in the record. I believe we've submitted a total of 5 volumes, 2 from appellant, 3 from us. If there's something in the trial record that supports appellant's case, it's incumbent on them to produce it, and they didn't. And my argument is certainly that there's nothing there, and I don't see why the court should have to comb through the record looking for something that we assert is not there. Mr. Olson started talking about Judge DeBrescu's order, and I want to note in Judge DeBrescu's order that at page 4, which is also page 4 of appellant's excerpts, he notes the educational neglect. He notes the allegations of sexual conduct or contact between both students and staff. He notes the lack of adequate shelter. He notes that the CPS investigation found the children didn't have clean clothes. He notes the medical neglect. I would ask you to look at Respondent's Record on Appeal, Volume 1, affidavit of Robin Landry at page 62, concerns rose to the level of removal. Affidavit of Rob Lawler at page 84, team found the allegations of neglect as a result of lack of supervision against ALA was substantiated according to the guidelines for substantiation of child protective service referrals. Same thing, four more affidavits, and they're cited too in my brief. Your Honor, what if something had happened to one of those children? We'd be in here having to argue why, after DCF received three separate complaints, went out there on four different occasions, had six social workers agree that immediate removal was necessary. Uh-oh, what if something had happened to one of those children and DCFS had been out there and had agreed that six social workers had agreed that the children needed removal and we hadn't removed? We'd be in here arguing almost the same thing, but from the other side. These are the kind of the situations that social workers face every day. We send a person with a bachelor's degree and a cell phone out to investigate allegations of abuse and neglect, and they have to make split-second decisions on whether or not the kids are safe. They shouldn't have to also worry about whether or not they're going to get sued. Mr. Olson argued that there's no policy in this state. I think the policy in this state is to protect children. And that policy is clear in Nevada Revised Statutes 432B that address allegations of abuse and neglect of children and what the statutory duties of the Division of Child and Family Services are. And in this case, the Division of Child and Family Services was acting pursuant to that statutory authority, and they were carrying out the policy of the state, again, which is to protect children from abuse and neglect. Lastly, I want to point out Mr. Olson's argument that ALA was shut down. I point you to our record on appeal, volume 1, pages 88 to 89. Abundant Life Academy was not operating legally, and they were presented with a cease and desist notice the first time DCFS went out there on April 21st, notifying them to cease and desist immediately and provide written notification that they were not operating in violation of law by April 29th. I also want to point out our record on appeal, volume 1, page 66, Abundant Life Academy admitted that it didn't have a business license, it didn't have a child care license, it didn't have a license from the Department of Education. It wasn't even a recognized business entity in the state of Nevada. I've got about 4 seconds left if you have some questions.
Questions, Justice Hayter, Justice Gibbons? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, Ms. Nichols, I want to thank you for your excellent and spirited argument in this matter. And this matter will stand submitted. And we'll be in recess. We'll call the court.